I'm not saying at that time I was innocent. I can say I was guilty, etc. But when you treat a man like a dog, etc., and I'm certainly not like a dog, if you strike a man down as hard as you can, and you actually have to repeat that, and you said, hold a man down with your actual shoes on the floor and said, kicking the man so violently that the man passed waste on him, and actually kicking him in his stomach and beating him on his both ankles, etc. That is not what you call law. This is this brutality. And then when you take the man to the hospital, the man, in my case, I was so severely hurt that the only alternative they had was to take me in a wheelchair to the hospital, etc. And then what they did, plant certain things in me, saying I had it. And obviously I got 6 years for this, although they brought two extra charges on me, which I was totally innocent of. And I literally had to speak for myself at the Old Bailey and said, look, if that is the case, why was that, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was fortunate enough to get find out guilty of these charges. I was, as I said, was given 6 years. But through good behavior, I got out on parole. And as soon as I got out on parole, about a year after that, but I went back to study, etc., to some study. And it seems like lightning struck twice. Police came, well, something happened. I just went to actually spoke to the people and said, look, I will have none of that, etc., etc. Made a complaint to the police. And did not even bother to come and investigate my complaint. Came around my house 2 days later, tried to come in from my window. Actually, I supported them, etc. Asked them what they wanted, etc. That's a different story. Climb up my garage roof, asked them to come up. The neighbors saw them, came and opened my door, came in with the spray and the baton. Came into my house, and I ran in when I saw this. I ran into the kitchen to protect myself. And I had the door was literally kicked open on me, sent me flying. Had nobody been in my house at the time, I would have been in jail now, etc. I went to the, they brought me down to what happened. They actually, when the person came down to see what was going on, i.e. my partner, came down to find out the commotion, what was going on. This guy just said, look here, this man's got a knife, etc. So rumbled my house with all these people with their, what do you call that, protective clothing and all the fans. Says, well, what? I haven't done anything wrong. Brought me to Trinity Road Police Station, and they are just terrible people up there. Protested my innocence, because I know a little bit of the law. I kept my mouth shut to see what they were going to charge me with. Got my solicitor, etc. They charged me for the actual charge, etc. For whatever thing. And what, threat to kill, assault, and afraid. Went to court. No papers, came back 2 weeks later, but before that informed my solicitor, they dropped the charges between, the 2 weeks, when I arrived 2 weeks later, the charge, the solicitor, the magistrate said, look, you have nothing on this man hasn't done anything wrong. The charges were thrown up, wrote to my MP, and because my MP, and that is another thing with prisoners, when you get into this sort of thing, always write to somebody who has a bit of power and find out exactly what is going on. And because I wrote to my MP, charges were brought back on me Although I have all the papers to prove that all the charges was dropped, I made a complaint. They were coming to investigate the complaint because they found out that they were trapped when my MP, etc. This was Gene Colston, etc. But they brought back the charge. Anyway, I went to the Crown Court twice. First of all, the charges, the police did not even turn up. Second, they just said, look, just keep the peace. But if I did not have my papers to show that I did not do anything wrong, I would have been in jail. And that is what they're going up on with. Chief Inspector Rowe, he's an elephant. He knows what his men is doing, and he knows what is wrong. The people at Potter's Head, when you do a complaint, anybody have ever wondered when one does a complaint and it goes to the PCA, why no one gets any joy? Because they're all corrupt. And I've got, as I wrote to this man, and I've got all the papers, just to prove it. So at the present moment, I'm just saying, I can't say too much about it. It is going through my barrister, so we can actually bring charges in there. But as I said, these things are still happening right here in Bristol, as this man is saying. And it says that one has to know or understand the system a bit to trap them, because it's extremely difficult. You can be innocent and end up in jail. It's just as easy as that. And who does that? Not the ordinary policeman, it's the boss, the chief superintendent. Those are Potter's Head. And then you have the PCA in London, is there. It's just an instrument for actually the police who commit the crime, for them to get away with it. That's what I've got to say. But as I said, there's a lot of innocent people in jail. And he's quite right about it. And it is a business. Who ends up in jail? Too bad. So unless they have somebody to fight for them. You're shrewd enough for me, which I knew how to go about it. That's why I'm still there. Where else I would have been sitting eating porridge. Okay, thank you.
Had plans or anything to bring any kind of lawsuit or something against the authorities? I know there's the case in the moment in America of the Earth First people who are taking the FBI to court for all the sort of COINTELPRO they got up to.
Well, I think what we would have did, we would have had this conference in Cuba, we would have did it as a whole. There are documents, and all of this was revealed sometime during the 80s, and I think that was Senator Church's investigation and hearing, that the Central Intelligence Agency, or the FBI in conjunction with CIA, there were over 250 wiretapping, which took place during that period. Of that 250, it could have been more, but of that 250, I think they say about 71% this number was against the Black Panther Party. I say this because if we would have went to that hearing in Cuba, the idea was to maybe use that as a forum to bring the plight of political prisoners, people who were victimized by COINTELPRO at that time, to the forefront. But that conference was postponed again for the second time. And this is, so we have to, you know, probably shelve it for later. Individually, no, I couldn't come up now with a lawsuit with regards to that. I think they made sure of that. Remember Geronimo. Geronimo ended up being awarded, Geronimo Pratt, that is. He ended up being awarded something like $2.5 million from the state and $2.5 million from the federal government. Whether he got the money or not, I don't know at this stage, but he was awarded that kind of money. But it may sound like a lot of money, but for 27 years in prison, that's not, you know, being convicted for a crime in which the FBI set you up for, knowing that you were over 350 miles away from it, and he held this evidence away from you all those years. It was a obvious, blatant conspiracy on the part. But anyway, the state was mindful of what had occurred with him. He was released a couple of years before I was released. And the terms in which I was released, they made sure that I would be able to bring about any lawsuit with regard to my criminal conviction. However, and this might seem like poetic justice if this occurred recently, you know, some in the year 2000, the ACLU, that is the American Civil Liberties Union, filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Angola 3. That's Albert Woodfox, Herman Wallace, and myself. And it alleged that the 29 years in solitary confinement constituted proof an unusual punishment. And recently, a federal judge kind of agreed with us, even though I'm released now, and the issue of injunctive relief on my behalf is a moot issue. It's not a moot issue on Herman and Albert's behalf. But what isn't moot in my case, and the answer to the question is that, should this trend continue, because we all ask for monetary damages. We ask for compensatory damage, and we ask for the other damage that come with punitive damages. And so this might, but the biggest thing that can come out of that suit is this. In America, there's a growing trend for these prisons that lock people up from now on for 50 years, if they live 50 years, these supermax. If we can get the court, if this trend continues, we can prevent that. Our case can prevent these supermax from not just expanded, but they would have to set some type of guideline in the court that would regulate the length of time that a person could be kept in solitary confinement. Now, in Louisiana and in America generally, and in my state, the state where I come from specifically, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeal does not per se say that solitary confinement constitutes cruel and unusual punishment. But the length of solitary confinement does. And this is where probably the poetic justice with regards to monetary damage may come in, because we won the first round, and there's a possibility that there will be some money involved in our being kept in solitary confinement. That's the civil aspect. In the criminal aspect, I could not, under the terms, I could not file like the round with you.
Thank you. Did you get
stuff
sent to you? Any publications, anything to
talk? I did. How did you
manage
to cope for 29 years?
You have to cope. You have to cope or you succumb. You give in, you die, you know. Maybe not physically right away, but you begin to die slowly within. I understood when I went to Angola, I had made a step, which was a bold step. And I just felt that whatever I encountered, it went with the territory, so to speak. And then again, like I tell people when I'm asked the question all the time, I just rose above. And while I was in prison, I didn't let prison get in me. I didn't become institutionalized. I knew I was innocent of the crime. And I fought hard. I was determined to continue to fight. I really would like to have done some other things, but I was just in a position that I couldn't do a lot of things. And so utilizing what was the means that was available to me, even though I understand the law, it's real hypocritical, and I do not even like engaging in law, but I got off into law, and I think this kind of helped me to overcome a bit. Plus, we continue even where we were in our political classes and so forth. We exercised a lot. We exercised our mind. And then again, I'd like to thank I used to lay on and thank a lot. And I thank all of this into overcoming or sustaining myself during that period. And then it was like a challenge, really and truly. After a while, you don't get inured to prison at all. At least I know I would never get inured to prison. I always wanted out, but it was also a challenge to exist, you know, and maintain my equilibrium from day to day. I worked at it, you know, and I was determined, you know, after seeing so many other people, because I've seen a lot of people, a lot of people whom I knew, even grew up with, have been on since childhood. I see it breaking, and I was determined not to let that happen.
Yeah, I wonder about, you know, like in the late 60s and 70s, you like all the hardships in American prisons, like, you know, with George Jackson and Attica and everything. Like, how did the Black Panther Party translate the struggle from the communities, etc., into the prison? How was that struggle like?
Well, I mean, it was easy. I mean, prison is a replica, small replica of the overall society. When you equate the two, it's easy to see that you're struggling for a different reasoning, but you're struggling really for the same thing. You have to struggle in society for change. Then there is also an added need if you're in prison, and especially if you're in prison unjustly, an added incentive on your part to struggle while you're in prison. Mm-hmm. Because when you're in prison, it is much more, it's a rough replica of the society in which you live in, what I call minimum custody. So you have added incentive to try to make some changes, not to try to beautify where you are, because we did it because we wasn't trying to bring we were not trying to bring the outside into the inside, because they weren't going to allow it. But we struggled because we saw it as a challenge that we needed to struggle, we needed to affect some change, and that was our way of harassing them suckers, harassing for a positive reason. I don't know if you get that trip or not, but that's the term we use. That was our way of doing it, you know, of harassment. Because they can harass you so much in prison, you know. And if you don't fight back, you die. Mm-hmm. Slowly, incrementally.
We've got a few minutes left. Any more questions?
You were saying about the privatization of prison, unless somebody else had one.
Yeah. No. Just make a question. Let's make a few questions, so and see what we've got time to work
on. No. I was just saying, you say about the privatisation of prisons, and I've heard a few people saying that economically, because basically, yeah, it generates money for companies, but it doesn't generate wealth, because it's like something eating its own tail. You know, the fact that they're making money out of incarcerating people, there's no wealth in it, there's just money in it. Does this mean something else in America's got to give? I mean, where's the money coming from? If you're imprisoning about 2 million people in America, what are they cutting to pay for that? Because something's got to pay for it. Somebody's got to pay for the profits for these companies.
Well, you know, in America, you have privatization. You still have state-owned prison, but the two work together. I don't know if this will answer your question or not. But, you know, I've read reports and some reports. One report I read where he pointed out that there was no money in private-owned business. But I think, I suspect that report probably was written by some of the corporations to try to divert people's attention from the true aspect of what prison is all about. When we speak of the growing prison industrial complex and expanding, and people are getting rich, if they aren't getting rich, But what you do have is people are profiting on the miseries of others, true, a vice that is in human. For instance, like in America, in the state that I reside, in Louisiana, in 1970 there were maybe two prisons. Now you have about anywhere from 12 to 15 prisons in the state. And then you have, Angola is 18,000 acres of land. Then you have a prison inside of a prison. If for instance, like since the economy, since there's no industry, so to speak, in the town of St. Francisville or in a lot of towns in areas of depressed areas in states where prison are built. What you do is when you build prison, you create an instant economy. Because if you create a 500-bed prison, what you do is you automatically hire at least from 800 to 1,100 guards. When you hire that many security guards, what you also do is you bring other businesses in the area. They want to live closer to the prison, so real estate become, kind of big time. What was ordinarily some maybe swampland become a nice piece of property. But that's not all of it. Stores are erected, supermarkets are erected. Then these prisoners have families in that area. And then what you do is big companies, big corporations and manufacturing companies, the prison will need maintenance equipment. And they overkill with building and selling prisons, state and private-owned prison equipment of restraints, tear gas, pepper spray, whatever you want to call it, guns to maintain the prison, or shackles, manacles, or whatever it is, belts, restraints, all type of stuff. And this is an industry. So the people that makes that profit from this, they profit off them. Now, they may not, I think it's when you say a billion-dollar enterprise, it probably means combined. Maybe no individual poison, but I would be hard-pressed to disbelieve that the person who owned Wackenhut, the one of the first to own a private prison, did not become rich in Correction Corporation of America. I would think that this is other than the main company, who built prison didn't become rich as a result of it. But it doesn't mean that everybody might become rich, but what they do is creates an economy in a depressed community where people are given employment. And what you do is this is being done on the misery of a fellow human being. So that's the profit on the one hand.
I just want to say something right here. They go to there's a prison down there, there's a category of sea prison, and they've got a massive complex, so machinery in it, etc., woodwork, etc. They find tables, find chairs, find this, etc. This is going to the stores, etc. This is very expensive things they're making. They pay the prisoners £7.50 or £5.50, etc., etc. Because I was in there, I refused to work anyway. Now,
£5
a week, 5 days. Right. The profit from there, who's getting the profit?
Uh-huh.
Right? And the equipment, what's the equipment? The tables and everything. Where's that money going to? Who's getting that?
Mm-hmm.
And they want people, if you don't go to work, you refuse certain privileges,
mm-hmm.
i.e. go to the gym, doing certain things. This is wrong.
Microsoft also used prison workers, and Starbucks coffee also used prison workers. Microsoft and Starbucks coffee also used prison workers, and lots of travel agencies,
yes,
and airlines,
yes,
used to use,
yes,
actually call centers,
yes,
inside
you know, quite right. When I was there, just before I was leaving, they got some sort of, nets, whatever, for clubs, etc. And they were paying to peanuts to and electronic gadgets and all these things. And the poor prisoners are suffering, and they get nothing.
That's one of the things I wanted just related to this, and you know, I know that there are more questions on that, but you know, like I said about John Bowden before, and it's one of the things that he says, you know, here in Hofield Prison in Bristol, and he's been in solitary confinement as well, in isolation, just because he refuses to do, you know, the crap jobs that you know that they basically. Put them to do on that, you know, and I wanted to say this because, yeah, it's related to all this we're talking about, but, you know, I think, you know, from the outside, I think we should be criticising that and showing support to prisoners and showing that, you know, that we know, you know, that all kind of labour slavery is happening in, you know, outside prison, but in prison it's just like, you know, the way people are like, I don't know, like forced to do it, you know, because if not, you go, you know, and you know, now that we're, you know, so many of us here, you know, like I want just to put forward this kind of proposal, you know, to organize a picket, demo, whatever, outside Hofield Prison, and I mean, mainly in solidarity with John Bowden, but, you know, just criticising the work system, isolation, beatings, etc. You know, I think it's something that, you know, apart from all the solidarity that all our comrades deserve, you know, that we have to show some solidarity with the people who are in our own city, basically. So I don't know if... people won't afterwards, like, this is the web page for Bristol Prisoner Support Group, and there is an email address as well. Yeah, it's on the site. If you want to come to the meetings as well, you can, you know, you can come along to them. But, yeah, if you want to, maybe after the meeting, we can decide or we can think of a day or when to do something like that, if people think like that. Yeah, pass them along and what's the tension?
How much time have we got, Martin?
5 minutes. Yeah, we can go to the pub afterwards. You fancy a drink?
Where I'm good. I'm sad when I get there.
You talked a lot about the prisoners are pitched against each other and all the violence against each other. What was the level, sort of over the time that you were in prison, what was the level of solidarity on a class basis between, say, black and white prisoners or like African American prisoners and
other
people in prison? What was the level of solidarity on the
class basis? Well, I guess if you answer the question on dealing with the solidarity of black and white on a national level first, before I bring it to my prison, when you look at Attica, when you look at the people, it was a cross section of people. Who participated in Attica quote rights riots unquote. So I mean you had you know all people, and there was some solidarity. I mean you had black, white, Latinos, Puerto Ricans, Mexican, a few Native Americans, and whoever else was in prison at the time. Closer to home, in my own home state, in Louisiana. It is unlike any other place as far as prison is concerned. Like I say, this is 18,000 acres, and you have prison within prison. They brought to a halt. It's kind of hard to maintain solidarity. You can have solidarity, but then they could almost instantly, take it away from you. And it's done so because they can, get everybody to participate in something that would be beneficial to all. Many will just refuse to do so. But Angola is a large enough place, and like I say, they have, if you want to count it, they have about 12 different penitentiaries inside Angola. They can, if 100 people participate in some type of just a work stoppage or whatever it is, they could take these 100 people and scatter them around Angola, and that 100 people, except for a few, would never even see each other again. So solidarity is kind of, difficult. However, in the area in which I live in, which was the ultimate place you can go, we saw solidarity among everybody in this place because they sent me to a punishment camp, which was another form of CCR, which is isolation, in 1999, and I was there for at least 9 months because we all engaged, and it was a passive protest. I guess about 98% of the people in my area participated, and you had an even number of whites and blacks. That happened sometime, but it's not much, the way Angola is situated, it's difficult, and it's kind of hard to bring the people together. Now you could, they got people, you have a lot, it's right for this. It's real right for this. And you try to instill in people, let's come together despite this, and we'll just create many areas like we have here. But it's a sacrifice that must be made. Everybody's not willing to make the sacrifice.
Okay, we'll have to leave now. And thanks, Robert King Wilkerson, for coming. And